information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9:59. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather interviews Mark Stein about the Stonewall Riot. And at 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Aisha Papacha Buchak, author of Trojan War Museum and other stories. At 11:30, Black Book talks to Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed, who will share their favorite reads. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th at 1 p.m. at the PCC Cascade Campus in Portland.
The MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration features music, theater, food, drink, dancing, and raffle prizes. There's also a vendor fair for the kickoff celebration to the MLK Run on Sunday, September 8th.
Again, that's the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th from 1 to 8 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, located at 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Joining me on the line is Mark Stein. He is the author and curator of the book, The Stonewall Riots, A Documentary History. It's published by New York University Press. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. This book is unique in that, aside from the introduction, the book is mostly comprised of excerpts from mostly LGBT press from Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York from 5 years before the Stonewall Riots, during the Stonewall Riots, and roughly 5 years after. How did the idea germinate behind the book?
Well, there are two really good scholarly histories of the Stonewall Riots, one by David Carter and one by Martin Duerman. They were published some years ago. They focus really on New York City in 1969. So I didn't really want to repeat what they had done. As a teacher, I really enjoy teaching my students how to do history, which requires reading materials from the past. So I came up with the idea of putting together a book that would present materials from 1965 to 1973, so a bit broader chronologically, a bit broader geographically, because mine is more of a national story, and as you indicated, lots of LGBT media materials, but also mainstream and alternative left underground media stories, a few transcripts of court cases, some demonstration flyers, photographs, maps, so students and other people who are interested would have the raw materials from which we can develop historical interpretations.
And then how long did this process take? Because not all these archives are digitally out there.
That's right. Well, I've been working in this field for almost 30 years, so some of it just comes from my previous research, but I guess I worked in earnest on the project for about 18 months.
Oh, wow. Like, as you stated, you are a professor of history at San Francisco State. Explain to the audience the difference between primary and secondary resources in doing research on this book.
Well, secondary sources are accounts accounts from later interpretations, analysis. So usually we think of secondary sources in the field of history as the work produced by historians years, decades, centuries later after the events described. Primary sources are really on-the-ground sources from the period. Those would be first-hand accounts from participants. They would include journalistic accounts. They would include, as I mentioned, transcripts of court cases from the time. So, you know, we really emphasize that in teaching history because why should we take the word of someone else rather than investigating primary sources ourselves? In the classroom, I sometimes riff on Judge Judy and how she always rules out, anything that she would classify as hearsay. And in a sense, that's what we do as historians. We want to see the materials from the past and not necessarily trust what other people have said about whatever event we're describing.
As we recently learned via the New York Times Magazine article about the fire on the lot of Universal Studios, which burned original master tapes of recording artists from Coltrane to Nirvana to the Carpenters, sometimes archive materials are not kept in the safest location. If for your original research for this book, you visit archives of LGBT for LGBT materials or from around the country. Talk about the process and how accessible are these materials which contain LGBT history for the general public to do their own work.
Well, it's a good question, and I'm also a member of the board of directors of the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, and it's been around for a few decades, and at its core, it is also an archive. But it's true, I also travel to other locations in the United States. So really, for decades, there have been community-based LGBT archive projects, and those projects were really motivated by knowledge that mainstream archives were not collecting LGBT materials. So if you wanted, decades ago, if you wanted to find copies of LGBT magazines, newspapers, letters, all sorts of other kinds of material, it was quite challenging, and you had to go to the physical archives, and these were usually community-based. Now, over time, some mainstream institutions have begun to do a good job of collecting materials. So I did a lot of work in the New York Public Library, which for a long time has had an LGBT collection. It actually is based on absorbing what had originally been some community-based LGBT archives. Those community-based archives now exist in a lot of forms. So in Southern California, what used to be two different community-based gay archives were absorbed by University of Southern California, so they're now available through USC Library, and whereas other places like in San Francisco and the GLBT Historical Society, we remain autonomous and community-based. Now, in the last few years, there's been a lot of digitization projects, so more and more of those materials are available online. Often you have to be affiliated with the university to have a free subscription to those archives. And I would also really emphasize there are a lot of materials that are still not digitized. Again, just to take an example, to do this work, the most widely circulating gay magazine of the second half of the 60s was called Drum. It was published in Philadelphia, and it's not fully digitized. Same thing for the 70s and 80s, the Los Angeles Advocate, which then became The Advocate, most widely circulating gay magazine of the 70s and 80s, still not fully digitized.
Yeah, so let's talk about the early LGBT movement. It came out of a reaction to the conformity of the 1950s and specifically the McCarthy era. What was it like to be LGBT in that time frame?
Well, it was certainly challenging in a variety of ways. Every state had laws against same-sex sex until Illinois in the early 60s became the first state to repeal its sodomy law. And lots of cities and counties had laws against cross-dressing, what was called gender impersonation, and that was really just the start of things. The American Psychiatric Association classified homosexuality as a mental illness. It was possible and common to be fired from your jobs if you were LGBT, which, by the way, is still the case in many American states.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult. Bars were raided on a regular basis. But I would also really emphasize that lots of the accounts that I reprinted suggest that conditions were improving in the second half of the 1960s. So we can't really flatten out the entire period from the 50s and 60s to equate, say, the Lavender Scare of the earlier part to what was going on in 1965 through the midpoint of 1969 when the Stonewall riots happened.
But to clarify, though, that they were improving for LGBT people within major cities. If you were out in, I don't know, Arkansas, not to pick on Arkansas, but they were still pretty bad.
Yes. We don't really... Actually, there's a whole lot more research to be done. There's some evidence, actually, that now actually stretches back centuries, that rural communities, that less populated communities, sometimes would have a live-and-let-live attitude kind of surprising degree of acceptance and tolerance for locals. Now, the distinction often made, right, is if you grew up in the community, if your family had been there for decades, and if you were just considered a little eccentric in terms of your gender presentation or your sexual interests, you know, that might be okay in some communities. There's a lot of variability, and I think we tend to think of the pre-Stonewall era as just monolithically awful. And one of the things I was trying to do with my book is to show that, you know, there actually was a lot of variability by geography, by exact period, and so things were actually changing.
It's interesting that you bring up monolithically awful, because, like, I'm trans. I transitioned I started in 2009. The period between 2009 and 2013 wasn't so bad, because even though it was pre-Orange is the New Black, people just, like, kind of left me alone, and it was after, like, trans visibility started is when, like, the real vengeful, hateful stuff started.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that doesn't entirely surprise me. And that's kind of a micro and very recent example of how things change. But, there's a case from colonial America that many of us teach, of a man named Nicholas Senshin, who was accused for decades of sexual seduction or sexual harassment or sexual violence. It's unclear in the sources, with his younger male servants in his household. And the community seemed to function by discouraging it, by disapproving of it, but not by bringing down the hammer of the law or the church, until finally, decades later, he began to cross new boundaries and new lines. And, you know, at least one historian has argued that it suggests that perhaps even in colonial New England, which supposedly is very, very repressive, there could be moments or situations of tolerance, not acceptance, and not celebration, but tolerance.
Well, and I also think that there's different roles for people that are extremely talented. For example, like in this time period that we're writing about, in this before the Stonewall riots, like Gore Vidal was on national TV with ABC during the, I think, 68 presidential debates.
Right, that's right. And James Baldwin was celebrated as a novelist. You know, we know a lot about Bayard Rustin and his struggles with the civil rights movement, where some people in the leadership of the civil rights movement accepted him and found ways to work with him, and others did not. And so, that's another example of some degree of variability. We know with Christine Jorgensen in the 1950s,
yes,
and then in the 1960s, there was some celebration and some sensational interest, but then there was also condemnation, criticism, and that changed over time, and it depended on which media source, which part of the country we're talking about.
Yeah, and just to give you listeners a frame of reference, you're an archivist, you're a historian. I love audio archives. This is a clip of what early LGBT rights organizations were up against. This is a clip from a Charles Keating of the Keating Five fame in the 80s. He financed a scare film. It's called Perversion for Profit, and it's actually hosted by LA news anchor George Putnam. I'm going to play about 3 minutes of this. It's all very Reefer Madness funny now, but it wasn't then.
I'd like to begin with a fact, a simple yet shocking fact. It is this. A flood tide of filth is engulfing our country in the form of newsstand obscenity. It is threatening to pervert an entire generation of our American children. We know that once a person is perverted, it is practically impossible for that person to adjust to normal attitudes in regard to sex.
Uh-oh.
Yet much of this material has been described as an illustrated, detailed course in perversion, abnormal sex, crime, and violence. It is also a fact that no matter who buys this material, 75 to 90% of it ends up in the hands of our children. Now, you might ask yourself, why this sudden concern? Pornography and sex deviation have always been with mankind. This is true. But now, consider another fact. Never in the history of the world have the merchants of obscenity, the teachers of unnatural sex acts, had available to them the modern facilities for disseminating this filth. High-speed presses, rapid transportation, mass distribution, all have combined to put the vilest obscenity within reach of every man, woman, and child in the country. In the past few years, this obscenity traffic and salacious newsstand literature have become increasingly worse, not only in content, but in volume. This traffic continues to increase and flourish for one reason. It is big business, profitable business, for the mercenary persons who produce it, and for its more than 800 distributors. The United States Supreme Court has described it as dirt for dirt's sake. We describe it as dirt for money's sake. Obscene literature is a $2 billion a year business. That's $2 billion. Through this material, today's youth can be stimulated to sexual activity for which he has no legitimate outlet. He is even enticed to enter the world of homosexuals, lesbians, sadists, masochists, and other sex deviants. The psychiatric terms for these unnatural sex acts are unknown to most decent adults in our country. But through this salacious material, these abnormalities are corrupting the minds and the hearts of our children. Perversion for profit. Here is the most vicious, the most insidious feature of these publications. They constantly portray abnormal sexual behavior as being normal. They glorify unnatural sex acts. They tell youngsters that it's smart, it's thrilling, it provides kicks to be a homosexual, a sadist, and every other kind of deviant.
Well, it is kind of fun. We are joined by Mark Stein. He's the author of The Stonewall Riots, a documentary history. We just heard a clip from a movie called Perversion for Profit. It gets funnier after that, believe it or not. So how, like, a lot of people credit Tumblr, specifically Facebook and a few other ones, of just like allowing other trans people, or YouTube especially, of allowing like other trans people to communicate with other trans people. How important were these like magazines and publications to the basically letting LGBT people know that they're not strange, they're not alone, and that there are other people like them?
I think they were incredibly important, and through the 1950s and early 1960s, there were three really pretty major what were called homophile movement magazines. First One Magazine, then Mattachine Review, and then the latter. They were published by three of the early gay and lesbian rights groups based in California. 1958, One actually won a U.S. Supreme Court case because the postmaster in Southern California tried to censor issues of One, and the Supreme Court upheld or sided with one magazine and declared that the post office couldn't exercise that kind of censorship. So they were, you know, they were very important. They reached first hundreds, then thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of readers, and then the landscape of those periodicals changed as we move into the 1960s. Over time, One and Mattachine Review disappeared, and a few trans periodicals emerged, including the Erickson Educational Foundation newsletter and Transvestia. And then Drum Magazine out of Philadelphia began publishing in 1964. This is something I studied in my first book, which was on Philadelphia gay and lesbian history. And its creative move was to combine the features of physique magazines. So on the cover, it featured, you know, muscly young men, shirtless often, sometimes even less clothing. And inside... And that made it like a physique magazine. There were many on the market, very successful. But inside Drum Magazine, there were, in addition to sexy photographs, there was hard-hitting news, coverage of the homophile movement, sometimes even legal briefs that were fully reprinted. And Drum had thousands of readers around the United States. And one of the interesting things leading up to the Stonewall riots is that it ultimately was suppressed by the federal, state, and local government and closed in May of 1969. So we're kind of missing coverage of the Stonewall riots from what had been for several years the most widely circulating gay movement magazine in the country.
When I hear the term homophile, it just kind of it as somebody that loves music, it conjures up the term audiophile, and most audiophiles are of middle to upper class. Was that the case for a lot of the audiences of these magazines?
Depending on how we define upper class, I think there was some class diversity in the readership. We don't really know the extent, but certainly it seems like a majority of the readers were middle class. We don't know a whole lot about the readership. Interestingly, I was able to track the circulation numbers for Drum because the FBI had it under surveillance, and they actually monitored how much postage the publisher purchased in Philadelphia when he mailed out the magazine, and had records that were better than any of the records that survived of the group that published Drum.
What was the circulation?
It reached in the tens of thousands.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about LGBT activism before the Stonewall riots. One of the things I like about your book is you break it up into sections. So you have LGBT journals talking about LGBT rights as in theory, but then you also break it up into activism so that there's a split between the theory section and the activism part. What were some of the major accomplishments of the Mission Society, One Incorporated, and Daughters of Bristils?
Daughters of Bilitis. And then, not the main organizations in the second half of the 60s.
Yeah.
The first part of my book, the first three chapters, which focus on the pre-Stonewall era, it's divided into three chapters. First, I look at gay bars and anti-gay policing. And then, as you say, I have a chapter on activist agendas and visions, and then a chapter on protests, political protests. So the chapter on political protests shows that there were more than 30 LGBT demonstrations, picket lines, sit-ins, riots, before the Stonewall riots. And some of them were directly successful. Others were successful in changing consciousness, mobilizing more people to get involved, educating the public. So they had success in different forms, but I kind of group together those protests in four categories. There were some that really embodied the strategy of militant respectability, and by that I mean they were they were demonstrations at Independence Hall and the United Nations and the White House and federal buildings. And there were rules about people wearing gender-conforming clothing, highly respectable, but at the same time, highly militant. Second, there were demonstrations that were more transgressive, So we have Sir Lady Java, an African-American trans woman who lost her job at a club in Los Angeles, organizing a demonstration there, the Compton's Cafeteria Riot in San Francisco, the sweep-in, where a group of hustlers and LGBT youth in the Tenderloin in San Francisco organized a cleanup of the neighborhood. So that's the second grouping. Then I look at protests against police violence, police raids, and there are two great examples of that in Los Angeles after raids on the Black Cat and the Patch, different kinds of LGBT protests. And then finally, I look at several months before the Stonewall riots, there was really a tremendous upsurge in LGBT demonstrations in the Bay Area that took off in March of 1969.
Yeah, talk about the Black Cat and the Compton's riot. The Black Cat, for me at least, has become in my consciousness. I read an article about it maybe a couple of Junes ago during Pride, and I had not heard of that before. The Compton riot, I had not heard it of all until I read your book.
That's interesting. There's a great documentary called Screaming Queens, done by Susan Stryker and Victor Silverman, about the Compton's Cafeteria Riot. And there, I really made an exception to my rule of only relying on documentary sources from the immediate period. We don't actually have any documentary sources of the Compton's Cafeteria Riot from 1966, when it occurred. But I do reprint the earliest trace we have in print, which is 1972. So Susan Stryker really was able to document the riot not through usual printed materials, but through primarily oral histories. So we know there was both a protest in July and then the riot in August at Compton's, which was a cafeteria in San Francisco's Tenderloin. Lots of trans patrons and routine harassment by the owners, the employees of the cafeteria, and the police. And one night in 1966, it crossed the line and the trans patrons began fighting back. By some accounts, it began with one basically tossing coffee into a police officer's face. And then a riot ensued, followed by another protest. So, you know, that's the basic outline of the Compton's Cafeteria riot. The Black Cat, there had been a very violent raid at a New Year's event at the Black Cat in Los Angeles. This was, I believe it was as turning into 1966, turning into 1967, and in reaction to that, there was an organized protest, and by some accounts, it had 400 participants, making it perhaps the largest of those pre-Stonewall demonstrations. Other accounts put the number a little bit lower, but either way, it was quite large, and in a sense, it serves as a preview of what happened at Stonewall, because it was triggered by a police raid on a gay bar.
In the 1960s, there was a height of the space race, and as Florence Conrad stated in her article, science is like God to most people, end quote. And the early groups wanted to find scientific evidence that they were not perverts or deviants. How successful was this approach in the 1960s?
Well, I think they cracked the consensus, the earlier consensus that LGBT people were mentally ill. And that doesn't mean that a majority of medical experts, scientific experts, psychiatrists had turned the corner, but a significant and increasingly vocal minority of experts began to challenge the conventional wisdom. We see that in particular. My second book is actually on Supreme Court decisions about sex, marriage, and reproduction in the 60s and 70s. It's called Sexual Injustice, and I focus there on a gay immigration case called Boutelier versus the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled against the gay immigrant who was challenging the provision of U.S. immigration law that provided for deporting and excluding people with psychopathic personalities, and that was understood to include quote-unquote homosexuals. So he lost his case in 1967 before the Supreme Court, but that said, one of the briefs in the case, which was put forward by the Homosexual Law Reform Society, a Philadelphia-based group, featured the expert opinions of several dozen sexologists, psychiatrists, anthropologists, sociologists, other types of experts, and it presented their view that homosexuality was not a mental illness. So, you know, that was quite substantial. The justices of the Supreme Court paid attention to it. The dissenters, of which there were three quoted from the brief, used that information, and there was at least a crack in the previous social consensus. And then ultimately, that effort would bear fruit, pardon the pun, in 1973, when the APA declassified homosexuality as a mental illness.
The homophile movement of the 60s, of the early 60s, before Stonewall, still has the same dynamics of our movement today. Clark B. Pollock, writing in The Homophile Puzzle, states, quote, "The square believes in organization, negotiation, in the manners and morals and techniques which dominate, which the dominant culture, which he addresses in its own language. And then we used to discover in Watts, California, the hip Negro has nothing to do with the square Negro and his organizations and those organizations that do not speak for him." This reminds me of the dynamic today between groups like, let's say, Human Rights Watch and people like me who want more radical reforms of society. How do activist groups address this large gulf in our understanding?
Yeah, really what I want to emphasize as a historian is that these conflicts are not new, and these issues are not new, and over and over and over again we see the pre-Stonewall movement depicted as small and accommodationist and respectable, and certainly parts of it were, but someone like Clark Pollock, who was the publisher of Drum Magazine, the magazine that I mentioned before, he was on the sexual cutting edge of the homophile movement, and he was not the only homophile movement leader who was calling for the movement to follow black power as opposed to civil rights as its model for activism. In San Francisco, in the months leading up to Stonewall, there were explicit calls for the gay movement to join the movement of movements and start a gay revolution. And those activists who were organized in a group called the Committee for Homosexual Freedom, you know, really represented much more radical politics than the previous organizations. So those conflicts and those divisions are really quite old. I think one of the things that's important when we think about commemorating Stonewall is to remember that Stonewall represented, in many respects, a rejection of the strategies of respectability that had been used by much, but not all, of the homophile movement in the earlier years. And there was some ambivalence by earlier activists about the idea of rioting as opposed to peacefully demonstrating as a strategy. You know, some of their goals may have overlapped, but certainly their tactics did not. And, you know, we can even ask questions about whether their ultimate goals were the same, because much of the more mainstream parts of the movement wanted inclusion and assimilation and were willing to accept the basic structures of American society, whereas pre-Stonewall and post-Stonewall, there were radicals who wanted to use the particular perspectives generated from gender and sexual marginality to challenge larger structures of society.
Well, even before Stonewall, Watts seems to have ignited a more radical LGBT movement.
I think that's right. You know, so the gay movement adopted as a slogan, gay is good, and that was clearly modeled on Black is Beautiful as a slogan, a slogan that came out of the Black Power movement. It's no accident, I think, that Stonewall became what it became, because it took the form of a riot, and gay activists were very invested in calling it a riot. The initial media stories, as is revealed in my book, did not refer to it as a riot. They called it a melee or a near riot. But right away, the gay press called it a riot. I think they wanted to associate what they had done with these very visible, very powerful, very threatening riots that had begun with Watts in 65, but that had actually been taking place every summer in the 60s after Watts, and so was very much on the mind of, I think, people during that period of time, and that was arguably as much or more of an influence than the nonviolent civil rights movement.
Yeah, let's talk about the Stonewall riots. In New York, in San Francisco, they had a guild of taverns, and the LGBT bars were actually owned by LGBT people, and they would actually show films, and it was more of a community. In New York, the mafia owned a lot of the LGBT bars. There were six characteristics of a mafia-owned bar. I don't remember one of them. I remember one of them actually being... it's darkly lit and there's goons at the door, and if you don't look the part of what they think gay is, they being the mafia, they don't let you in. And then they had this, like, in New York they had mafia, the mafia owned the bars, then basically the alcohol control board made it so that it was illegal to serve gay people knowingly as a bar, and then the police had kickbacks and it put gay people in a tenuous situation.
That's right. There was a payoff system whereby the bar owners and managers paid off the police in order to reduce, so not completely eliminate, police raids. But on the issue of, you know, the legality of bars, that's a perfect example of how things were changing. There was the famous sip-in in New York City in the mid-60s, where gay activists were determined to challenge the New York State rule that merely serving a homosexual, quote-unquote, was a violation of liquor licensing laws. And they ultimately succeeded through direct action. They insisted, they went into bars, they announced that they were homosexuals, and they asked to be served. And when they were denied service, they had the basis for a court case, and they succeeded. You know, and now what that meant was that the bars could no longer be closed down purely for serving, quote unquote, homosexuals. Now they those who wanted to raid or close the bars had to find additional reasons, so disorderly conduct or violation of gender or sexual laws or lewd behavior. So I don't want to say that it solved the problem, but it was an important victory in New York City. They also succeeded, the activists in New York City also succeeded in getting the mayor, John Lindsay, to promise to eliminate sexual entrapment by police, where attractive police officers would put themselves in a position where they could allege that bar patrons or public park denizens might come on to them or might be accused of coming on to them, and then they'd be arrested. And Lindsay promised to eliminate that practice after activists pressured him on it. So there were these interesting and important changes happening. But it is true that even as we reached Stonewall, the bars were still largely mafia-owned and controlled. There were still, you know, regular bar raids that would happen. In the case of the Stonewall, it was justified by the authorities on the grounds not simply that they were serving homosexuals, but that there were violations of liquor licensing laws, which there probably were, you know, that there might be violations of other gender and sexual laws going on inside the bar.
Well, and the other thing, too, is Stonewall, people look at it with, like, rosy lenses, but the Stonewall was a mafia bar, and not only was it dark and gross, it was also, they didn't sterilize their glasses, and so I think it was hepatitis breakouts there. It was a place of community, because a lot of street people, like, that left, you know, smaller towns to move to New York to try to at least find some semblance of acceptance, were there. And so it was community, even though it was a kind of a deranged community at that.
So, yeah, it had exactly those two dimensions. It was exploitative. There were reports of watered-down drinks. There were, you know, the owners and managers were not necessarily kind to the patrons. They didn't keep conditions in good order. As you say, there were really bad cleaning and sterilizing and sanitization processes in place. And there were, you know, restrictions at the door. Gay liberationists after Stonewall would criticize places like the Stonewall for being, you know, examples of business exploitation or capitalist exploitation. But at the same time, it was, as you say, a gathering place, a place to find community, a place to enjoy oneself. And that's why some people liken what gay bars were for the LGBT community to what churches were for the black community or factories were for the union movement, that they were places where people gathered. They were places where solidarity was formed, where consciousness was changed, and ultimately they could become places of politicization, you know, which we know happened in churches for the civil rights movement, we know happened on factory floors for the union movement, and bars functioned in some of the same ways for the LGBT movement.
So you have a theory called the history of bar politics. Can you describe that?
Well, I think you're referring to, I try in my introduction to talk about several different ways historians have interpreted why the Stonewall riots occurred. So one theory has been that we should see the Stonewall riots as a culmination of homophile movement organizing in the 50s and 60s. The second theory, which is I think the one that you're alluding to, argues that, we should interpret Stonewall as a culmination of bar-based resistance practices that stretched back decades. So LGBT people in bar-based contexts might not have thought of themselves as activists or part of the homophile movement, but they did have a whole panoply of strategies to resist oppression, and that really provided the basis for what happened at Stonewall. The third theory emphasizes the influence of other radicalizing social movements, such as Black Power, the anti-war movement, the counterculture, the women's liberation movement, on LGBT communities, and suggests that that was kind of the spark that lit the flame in 1969. And then I try to put forward a fourth theory, which is really a revival of an old theory that I found in one of the primary sources from 1969. And that theory draws on a sociological theory that says that revolutions are most likely to happen not when conditions are at their worst and not when there's a period of slowly improving conditions, but rather when there's a period of improving conditions that's followed by rapid reversals. And that theory had been developed to explain all sorts of revolutions and rebellions in world history by a sociologist and political scientist named Joseph Davies. And one gay journalist in 1969, reporting for The Advocate, used that theory to say, hey, that looks exactly like what's been going on in New York City. Conditions have been slowly improving. In the second half of the 60s, there were those reforms that were achieved with Mayor John Lindsay, and then a series of things happened. And I try to fill in the gaps in that account by talking about all the reversals, the election of Richard Nixon in November 68, his inauguration in January 69, a series of police killings of LGBT people in March, April, and May, and June of 1969, and a series of police raids on LGBT bars. And so I find that a very interesting way of thinking about why the Stonewall riots happened when they happened. I think people were sensing that the mood of the country was changing after all the reforms of the 60s, that we might be entering a much more conservative period, symbolized by Nixon's call for a return to law and order politics, and I think that contributed to the anger and fury that erupted at Stonewall, the sense that things were no longer heading in the right direction.
We have a president today that believes in law and order politics, and things are turning for the worse. Trans people are being booted out of the military. There's different HHS documents that are saying that you can't even mention the word trans within government literature. When do things start, as far as activism goes, like, when do things start happening in the present day?
Yeah, no, I first of all, I have to acknowledge, you know, we talk a lot in history about how contemporary events often influence our interpretations of the past. And I think that one of the reasons I was attracted to that theory, originally invoked in 1969, was that it really did map so well onto our current situation, and I wondered if it was applicable. Now, you know, that theory has largely been disproven as a kind of hard and fast, social science causality theory.
Yeah.
So we can't say that X plus Y equals Z in the sense of social change. I still think it's an interesting theory, even if it isn't applicable in 100% of circumstances, doesn't mean that it doesn't have value and explanatory potential. And so I think some people would say that we are seeing signs of those kinds of eruptions right now. I think sometimes it takes a little bit a little while for people to figure out exactly what to do next. If one of the more progressive candidates defeats Trump in the next presidential election, we could look back and say that even just within the realm of electoral politics, that those periods, that period of reversal was followed by, you know, a reaction, you know, in the electoral realm. But on the street, you know, level, and on the level of revolution and rebellion, I'm wondering that same thing myself. Maps so carefully onto our situation, why aren't there more strategically savvy direct action protests happening? And I have to say that, you know, in the last third of my book, where I look at demonstrations that happened in the 4.5 years after Stonewall, I really enjoyed showcasing the creativity of LGBT activism in that period. They were really smart about their targets. They were really smart about the kinds of demonstrations they organized. They were very media savvy. It reminded me in a lot of ways of AIDS activism in the 80s. And I think we really need some of that right now. I haven't seen that same kind of strategic creativity in a lot of the protests that are happening against the Trump administration and the conservative turn in American politics.
That's what I really like about your book, is it focuses on the people on the street and the people that are looking only to themselves to improve their collective situation. Electoral politics really doesn't enter the picture in your book until 1972 with the Democratic primary. I think some people are just hoping that, you know, we'll have AOC Jesus liberate us all.
No, that's right. You know, as a political person myself, I tend to orient myself to social movements rather than political candidates. I think it's dangerous to put too much hope. I think electoral politics is very important, and I think the actions of political figures are really important. That doesn't mean that that's where I place my energies and my resources. So, I'm much more interested in social movement stories. I think those provide the foundations for what happens in national, state, and local politics. And if we have powerful movements advocating for social change, you know, then I think social change can happen. And in my book, I've sensed within at least queer studies in higher education, there's been so much attention over the last couple of decades to theories about gender and sexuality, but I think we have a much less sophisticated and developed sense about action. And I was really struck in some parts of my book, you see radical vision statements that call for XYZ, and then nothing that translates from that into political action. And then other times you see a direct connection between the visions and the agendas that people are articulating and then what they actually do to make social change. So, yeah, I wanted to shine a stronger light on LGBT protests and demonstrations, both before Stonewall, for reasons we talked about earlier, and post-Stonewall.
Well, what's interesting about the visions is some of the really easy things that you would think would be very attainable, like non-discrimination laws in employment and housing. We don't have a national EDNA. We just don't. You can get fired for being gay in Kentucky or something like that.
That's right. And we see in the period covered by my book the early development of those laws. So first in East Lansing and San Francisco, those were the first jurisdictions. And really, we should recognize, we talk about LGBT rights laws. Those were basically amendments to the existing civil rights laws that prohibited discrimination on certain bases. And so those laws existed and generally covered race, nationality, national origin, religion, sex. But the goal in the early 70s of the LGBT movement was to add what was often called sexual preference in that period, and then later gender identity and gender expression. And you know, I've argued in a previous book that what we really began to see in the 1970s was a lot of geographic variability. So we had jurisdictions in the United States that repealed their sodomy laws, that repealed their their cross-dressing laws and that had anti-discrimination laws based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And then we had parts of the country that had neither of those, none of those things. In the absence of national legal change, things were left up to our cities and towns and counties and states. We're not the first movement to confront that. If we think about the history of interracial marriage, that was exactly the situation that led to Loving versus Virginia in 1967, that nationalized what had been going on in many states to legalize interracial marriage. We saw that with same-sex marriage, where first we saw change at the state level, and then eventually it was nationalized through Supreme Court decisions. It's taken a really long time to have basic national anti-discrimination law, and it remains a question whether we're going to achieve that, if we do ever achieve it, through a reinterpreting of the ban on sex discrimination, which the courts could do, or whether we're going to see it through national legislative reform. Those are the two routes that I can envision as to how that would happen.
Or does a state like Mississippi need its own version of the Stonewall Riots?
That
can definitely be it. One of the things I find interesting is that we were talking earlier about the actual Stonewall, the bar, the physical spatial location. And it was there for like 2 or 3 years. The cops of the Sixth Precinct didn't bother it. And then they raided it once, I think, on a Tuesday. And then they came back on a Friday. They didn't raid it when it was empty. They raided it when it was jam-packed. And then that Friday is when things broke loose. We'll talk about the actual night of the riot.
Yeah, it's not clear why they raided, at 1 or 2 in the morning, as opposed, as you say, to earlier in the evening when raids were more common. There are theories that there were official or unofficial investigations into blackmailing, rings or sex work or extortion plots, or sex with minors, other kinds of investigations that might have been going on, where they did want to catch people, who were there, large numbers of people who were there. We don't really know, and I do emphasize one of the mantras in my introduction is there's always more to the story. I say that several times. So there's a lot that we don't know, and I try in my book to resist the impulse to make authoritative, definitive statements, because I think there are too many people who write and speak as though we know for sure certain things happened, certain people were involved, when accounts differ, accounts are in conflict, so there's a lot that we don't know. But yeah, the police initially undercover entered the bar. It actually began on the evening of the 27th, and then when they declared themselves and asked for identifications and began sorting through who they wanted to detain and who they didn't, that's real. That by then it was in the early morning hours of June 28th, and so as was typical, they let many people go. They detained disproportionately people of color, trans people, bar managers, bartenders, people without IDs, people who talked back or fought back, and let everybody else go. Those folks, many of those folks, remained on the streets nearby, and they would play a critical role in what happened next. And then when the police began to escort those in the bar to the police wagons outside, that's when the crowd that had gathered outside began to erupt. And so some of the people who were put into police wagons either freed themselves or were freed by other people in the crowd. There were some physical scuffles involved, and eventually the riot, the crowd was riled up enough with throwing coins, throwing objects, breaking the windows, that the police retreated inside the bar, and there was an effort to light the bar on fire. There was a uprooted parking meter that was used to try to break down the door, and at least by some of the accounts, at exactly the final moment before the police inside might have gotten even more violent and perhaps even used their guns, reinforcements arrived from the police and began to try to get the crowd under control and take more of the patrons away in wagons. And what ensued, yeah, was then several nights of rioting.
Yeah, what's amazing is one of a Village Voice reporter was actually in the bar with the police because he was kind of an in-between zone, and the police go, here, you need to be in here with us. And then they talked about how the discrepancy between beating up an LGBT person versus an African-American when they said, one of them said, quote, you can't beat a sick man. It's just amazing, like, even though that the LGBT movement was vilified, like, African Americans are still lower on the totem pole for New York City police at that time.
Yeah, that's I find that a really, really interesting quotation. So yeah, one of the police officers, he's basically saying he used the N-word, but I'll say black riots more than fairy riots or faggot riots, because you could beat up he used the N-word, African-Americans, but you can't beat up fairies because they're sick, and you can't beat sick people. Now, you know, first of all, it's horrific, you know, what that suggests about the police attitudes about African-Americans. Second, it's really fascinating about how they sort through, you know, the comparison between LGBT people and African-Americans. It, of course, we understand today, suggests a non-intersectional understanding that there are LGBT people of color who are a part of both communities. You know, but I also find it really fascinating because, you know, there have been such intense community-wide debates about the whiteness of the rioters, the people of color who played important roles in the rioters. That quotation, at least, suggests that that police officer did not perceive the rioters as brown or black.
Yeah.
Because I think if he had perceived them as brown or black, he would have been happy to beat them up. And, you know, you put that alongside the other 30 or so media accounts that I present, and it leads to lots of important questions, I think.
To this day.
Oral histories, you know, have emphasized the important role of people of color. But those accounts from the time do not. There's a few Puerto Ricans mentioned and a few accounts. I would think that many journalists would have, given the moment, would have referred to the rioters as black or brown if they had been. And so why did they not? And I think on trans issues there's a similar community-wide debate. There we do get clear accounts of the prominent role played by, you know, genderqueer trans people, at least that's how we might refer to them today. And there, too, there's a lot of interesting stuff. The trans periodicals of the period, the Erickson Educational Foundation and Transvestia, did not cover the Stonewall riots. And it was the gay press, especially the Mattachine Society of New York newsletter, that insisted that the trans people played a prominent and important and visible role at the forefront of the rioting. Fascinating too.
Real quick before we leave off, my guest has been Mark Stein. He's the author of Stonewall Riots, a documentary history book, one of the people that was arrested at the riots was Dave Van Ronk, who is for those of you that liked Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers film was the inspiration for that. Like, how did he get there?
Yeah, so he, by all accounts, at least that I've seen, is identified as straight, was an active folk singer in the Greenwich Village music scene, and was walking by and got involved in the fighting, and then was pulled in by the police. And he apparently took a swing. He may have been drinking. I think he may have been performing down the street or going to a performance down the street. It's a good reminder that there were allies who were involved. It's a good reminder that non-LGBT people can be victimized by anti-LGBT violence, and you know that was the case. That was certainly the case with him. I haven't seen any interviews with him about his role. Later interviews with him about his role in the riots. That would be interesting to look at. But
definitely
one of several figures who didn't necessarily identify as LGBT, but who were there.
My guest has been Mark Stein. The book, The Stonewall Riots: A Documentary History. It's a great read. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is the Heather McCoy Show. We'll be back next week with only God knows what. Stay tuned for more public affairs. And this is, of course, the Heather McCoy Show.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:58. Coming up after the message, you'll hear Between the Covers. David Naiman speaks with Aisha Papatya Buchak, author of Trojan War Museum and Other Stories. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk, Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed will share their favorite summer reads. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mike to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Aisha Papatya Buchak, a graduate of Princeton and the MFA program at Arizona State University. Buchak has taught at Oberlin and Minnesota State University and was the director from 2011 to 2013 of the creative writing program at Florida Atlantic University, where she is a professor of English. She's also a contributing editor for the literary journal Copper Nickel. Buchak's stories and essays can be found in One Story, Creative Nonfiction, The Kenyon Review, The Iowa Review, The Fairy Tale Review, and Witness, among others, as well as garnering her an O. Henry Prize and a Pushcart Prize. Aisha Papatya Buchak is here today to talk about her much-anticipated debut collection of short stories out from W.W. Norton entitled The Trojan War Museum and Other Stories. Publishers Weekly, in their starred review,